hello to all of you. It's a complete joy and pleasure to be hanging out with you. And in just a moment, I'm going to mute you. And then at certain points, I'll unmute you, and we can ask questions and have conversations. So the chat you're listening to, which you may or may not be able to hear well, is a chant of Om Namah Shivaya. It's being sung by the singers of the art of the sacred art of living, and it's an example of one of the great karmic healing tools that we're offered by the traditions. That is the sound of chanting in mantra. So today, as we enter into our practice and learning on turning your karma into destiny, which is actually one of the great sacred subjects. It's a subject that most of the great Eastern traditions deal with in depth. And it's an especially important one for those of us who are on a path to freedom, on a spiritual path, on a mystical path, simply on the path of knowing ourselves. And it's also one of the most mysterious. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the texts of my tradition, of the Indian tradition, that deals with karma most specifically, Krishna says to Arjuna, this is his final word on the subject, karma is mysterious. The ways of karma are mysterious. Because the truth is that no matter how many past life regressions we do, no matter how many psychics we go to, it's very difficult to know exactly how a certain action will turn out. And of course, it's even more difficult to know what situations account for our present life circumstances. Of course, studying karma helps us get a sense of what it actually means to create what the Buddhists call skillful and unskillful karmas, positive and negative karmas. And at a certain point in the spiritual journey, we may begin to intuit past lives in meditation, which is quite an interesting experience, as you can imagine, and as some of you may have actually experienced. And we also begin to understand something of the enormous sweep of the chain of karmic causation. Karma, as we'll be looking at later, as we'll discuss later, is actually the law of evolutionary causation. In other words, what's often called the law of karma is in fact a practical description of how everything that we do and everything that everybody else does is interconnected. And as we start to look at the different types of karma, we start to understand something of the incredible web of interconnection that we're all, let's say, entangled in. And which we actually can learn the skill of navigating. So, one other thing I'd like to say on this subject before we go into our meditation and our initial chant and meditation is that most of the great traditions have teachings on causality that include the understanding that individual consciousness migrates from body to body over many lifetimes. And the way that traditions say this is different. In other words, some of the Eastern traditions say that consciousness transmigrates, but not carrying the personality of the previous life. Other traditions say that, in fact, the personality does go along with our consciousness as we transmigrate. There's an enormous amount of literature on this in Buddhism. There's quite a bit of it in Hinduism. It was part of the Pythagorean and Platonic and Neoplatonic traditions in Greece. Hindus, of course, say that the Greeks got it from them. And it's very much a part of the Jewish tradition, the Talmudic tradition, even to the point where in Hasidism, in the Hasidic world, there are many, many stories that involve past life relationships being healed or fixed in the present. And in fact, I've always felt that one of the reasons for studying and learning about how karma works is precisely so that we can heal or fix situations that we intuit are creating difficulties in our lives and standing in the way of our practice. And this, in fact, is probably the primary motivation for the Eastern spiritual traditions and the Western spiritual traditions teaching about karma, because what's the point of knowing about karma if you don't know how to heal it? So there are two things that are really important to understand about this extraordinary fact of life. The first is that karma is inexorable. That is to say, actions have consequences. Every action has a consequence. So we're constantly acting and thinking and therefore constantly creating consequences. And this is a truth that can be either scary or liberating. And it's the same truth that can be scary or liberating. In other words, the fact that actions have consequences is scary, and the fact that actions have consequences is liberating, because in fact, it is the fact that actions have consequences that make it possible for us to transform, that make it possible for us to free ourselves, that make it possible for us to evolve, and on a just very simple level, for life to get better. So this class is not teaching karmic fundamentalism, that is, not that sort of Hammurabi's code, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth approach to karma. One of the things that I really want to do in these three classes is dispel some of the myths about how karma operates, as well as give you some practices and some contemplations that will help you explore your own karmic patterns. And I should say that one reason that Debbie sent around an email suggesting that some of you might want to have a partner is that we'll be doing some, you know, I'll be offering you some homework practices that are very helpful to do with another person in dialogue. You can do it on the phone. And I think that many of you will find that this is a subject that's extremely interesting to talk about, especially as you begin to look into your own karmic patterns. So let me just say a few words about the teleconference satsang format. I know that many of you on this call and tuning in via the MP3 have practiced with me, some of you often, and are very familiar with the transformative practice teleconferences. So one of the things, though, that if you're new to the class, it's important to recognize, as you will over the course of the class, is that when we are together during these 3 weeks, we actually do form a genuine sangham, a community of practitioners. And it happens in quite a subtle way. It happens even for people who never participate in the listserv or speak up in the classes. Even though everyone is not present on every call, everyone becomes part of this very subtle vortex of community that seems to be part of the power of these classes. So you'll also find that if you miss a class and download it later, that the energy of the class and the energy of the community is present, that you'll feel it supporting you as you practice during the parts of the class that involve me and my voice and other people being on the call. And you'll also find it as a kind of palpable support during your practice in between classes. You will be getting homework assignments, including a meditation homework assignment. And part of the, let's say, the conditions of the class, part of what makes these transformative practice journeys work is that we do practice meditation for 20 minutes a day at least, and I'll give you a practice which will be our main practice for the class. And you'll also be receiving some exercises for contemplation and self-inquiry, which will actually make a big difference in the way you experience what we're doing here. And you'll also be invited to participate in the listserv, where you can send in questions or comments, share your experiences, interact with other people, And again, those of you who are old-timers in the transformative practice classes know that the listserv is actually one of the great boons of these classes, that there's a lot of very interesting learning and communication that takes place on them. If you have questions for me, I'll answer them on the listserv, so you can send them in. And if your question is too personal, that is to say, if it's a question that has to do with this, what we're learning here, that feels like you don't want to share it with everybody, you can share it with me privately. My email address will be on the homework assignment. So I'd like to ask you now to take out your chat sheets, which hopefully you've downloaded, and also the handout sheets that were sent out yesterday. It's called Turning Karma into Destiny, and we're going to be going over it, actually using it as a partial outline for the class, because today I actually want to download some of the karmic basics, and then we're going to actually talk about karmic relationship and do a practice which hopefully will free you from all the chains of relationship in one of your karmic relationships. That's a joke, actually. But the practice that we'll be doing is really quite effective. So we're going to be doing our opening chant, Om Namah Shivaya Gurave. We'll be chanting to the accompaniment of Krishna Das. And this chant, which, again, we practice at the beginning of every transformative practice journey class, invokes the presence of the underlying divine energy that is the source of the universe, that is also the teacher, the inner teacher, and which comes through the teacher, every teacher who tunes into the deep energy of transformation, who tunes into their own source. When we invoke this energy, we're invoking the energy of the sacred space, the sacred vortex, so that the inner teacher can begin to allow these words, the words that I speak, and the experience of practice that you enter into, that can allow these to resonate truthfully, to resonate in a transformative way, and actually to open all of us to the deepest part of our heart, the deepest part of our soul. So the words of the chant mean salutations to the eternal Guru, the self of all, who lives within every one of us, whose nature is pure being, pure awareness, and pure joy, who is eternal, who is never absent, who is luminous, who is ever present, and who is contacted in the deep heart. And we'll follow that with a short prayer offering our practice for the benefit of all beings. So you can place yourself in a comfortable upright posture, having the feeling that your sitting bones are sinking into the floor, that your spinal column is elongating upward through the crown, let your shoulder blades come onto the back, and let your attention come to the breath. Imagine that your body is hollow, and that with every breath you're taking in energy, prana, vital force coming up through the soles of your feet, flowing up through your body to the crown. And then with the exhalation, have the feeling that breath, prana, vital force flows down through your body and out the feet. Just have the sense of the breath sweeping through your body for a moment, flowing in from the feet to the crown, down from the crown to the feet, and just allow it to happen Don't worry about deepening the breath or trying to force the breath. Just allow your sense of the breath flowing through a hollow body to vitalize yourself as we enter into this chant. Imagining every cell and pore in your body breathing in and out, is if you're feeling your entire body expanding with the inhalation, and then flowing back into its normal form with the exhalation. Breath flows in through the toes, flows up through the crown, sweeps back down to the toes. And with this breath, this sweeping breath, imagine that you're clearing from your field whatever residue of charged moments or difficult moments or anxious moments that you may have acquired during the course of the day. Imagine that as the breath sweeps through your body, it's clearing the contractions, the fear, the worry, whatever feels like it's sticky. And it's happening without you having to make a big effort or without you having to throw it out. You're just allowing the breath, the vital force of the universe, to flow through you with unconditional love. Karma means action. It comes from the root kra, which for those of you who are Sanskrit mavens is the root of the word kriya, which is Sanskrit for action or activity. So in the Indian tradition, the word karma is applied to any action you do. Karma yoga. There's a whole science of ritual in both India, in India and in Tibet. Which you practice certain ritual actions in order to create effects in the world, and that's those ritual actions are called karmakanda, the path of ritual, the path of act, one of the paths of action. But of course, karma also means the stored results and effects of your past actions and thoughts, and the effect that they have on your present and your future. So karma, the actions performed through the body, the mind, and the speech, and this is very important, they can entangle us or they can help us to disentangle ourselves. One of the main distinctions about karma that is made in the texts of the tradition is that the two basic kinds of karmas are the ones that are binding and the ones that are liberating. That is to say, if you look at your chart, the klesha or afflicted karmas and the aklesha, that is, unafflicted karmas. The root of karma is not knowing who we are. Karma, the karmic predicament, arises from not recognizing that everything is a part of everything else, not realizing that there's just one energy in the universe that is doing everything, that is acting as us, that is acting as everything in the world. And out of this basic misunderstanding arises the tendency to identify with our particular body, our particular personal history, and with all the stories, all the energies, all the structures, all the beliefs that come to us through our DNA, through our family, through our ancestors, through our culture. And out of that sense of not being everything, of not being connected, and of being one particular person, we develop the desire to have pleasant experiences, successful experiences according to our cultural definitions of success, and to avoid painful ones. And of course, what this means is that we begin to be afraid of anything that threatens our body and our egoic personality, and we begin to become angry and hostile to anyone or anything that seems to get in the way of the pleasure and success of this being. And this is all, these particular qualities, which are pretty much built into the human system until we start doing the practices that begin to untangle them, are the basis of karmas. They're the basis of what in Sanskrit is called the kleshas, or the afflictions, or the poisons, that all stem from this basic misunderstanding about reality. There's a wonderful story from the Puranas of India, which I'm going to tell you in a very short version. And it's about a sage named Narada, who was a very close personal friend of Lord Vishnu, who was one of the forms of the divine in Indian mythology. And one day, Narada and Lord Vishnu are sitting by the banks of the Yamuna River, and Narada asks Vishnu, "Tell me the secret of karma." So Vishnu says, "Here, take this bowl, go down to the river and get me a glass of water." So Narada takes the bowl, he goes to the river, which happens to be in flood, and as he leans over to fill the glass, he falls into the river. He's tumbled down the river, and after miles upon miles of incredibly difficult and painful tumbling over stones and being tossed about by the water, he's fished out of the water by a farmer who takes him into his hut, feeds him, dries him, and gives him to the care of one of his daughters who nurses wounds. And of course, because it's that kind of story, over time, as Narada is healing, he's very attracted to the daughter. Finally, he marries her. Her father gives him a hut that gives them a hut to live in together. They have three children. Years go by. Narada farms quite happily. He goes through the usual domestic difficulties. And then one day, 5 or 6 years later, the river floods again. But this time it comes up on the bank, and it drowns his hut. It carries away his wife, his three children. And Narada is utterly, absolutely desolate. He's grieving. He's thinking of suicide. And in fact, in his pain, he flings himself into the river and is fished out by Lord Vishnu, who stands looking at him with that smile of unconditional love, and says to him, "Where's my glass of water?" So this is the mystery of karma. And as Vishnu later explains, the reason that this karma, this karmic predicament occurs is because we forget. We get caught up by circumstances. We forget who we are. We forget our origin. And so the cure for karma is remembrance. In fact, in the tradition, in the Indian tradition, it's said that because karma is endless, because of our forgetfulness, that the only thing that ultimately cures karma is the recognition of our true nature. Shankaracharya, the great Indian teacher and Buddha himself, says that when we have one glimpse of our true nature, it burns the karmas of countless lifetimes, which is an extremely good reason to meditate. Our ideas about karma have been quite influenced by the notions of guilt and sin that we've inherited from the Jewish and Christian traditions. And this is not useful. In the East, the popular notion of karma has often led to a fatalistic attitude towards life, an attitude that that our life situations are the result of something we did in the past, and that therefore there's not too much we can do about them. But if we're good and obedient to all the laws of the hierarchy, that we'll get a better birth next time. This also isn't very useful. And then there's the New Age attitude towards karma, what I'll call the New Age attitude, you know, perhaps the attitude of what we might call the New Thought Western traditions, which often focuses on trying to find out what happened in your past lives that helped create, say, your tendency to low self-esteem or your lower back pain or the fact that you get respiratory infections. And I'm sure that many of you, as I have done past life regressions or gone to Vedic astrologers who often can tell you something about past lives. And many of you, like me, have found out that you were shot, smothered, drowned, etc., etc., and that in some way you're carrying the effects of past lives in your body. Who knows if these insights are true? But I do think that one thing that we can learn from our exercises in looking into past karma is simply to recognize how much responsibility we actually have for our own experience. You know, according to Hindu and Buddhist philosophy, the law of karma is as much a part of the universal order as the laws of physics. And what that means is that when something happens to us, it's not because someone's trying to punish us or because elemental forces are mad at us, although there are types of karmas in which we get caught in elemental situations that have nothing to do with us. But in general, karma is a theory of causation. It's a way of explaining the events of our lives that actually gives us some agency, some power, even if it's only the power to recognize that there's something at work in our lives besides blind fate. In this sense, karma is the core process that allows human beings to evolve. It's actually the doctrine of evolutionary causality, and it works in the material world. And it also works very much in human lives. And this is one of the reasons why the understanding about reincarnation is so important. It's so crucial to spiritual practice and to the understanding about what it actually means to evolve your consciousness. Because obviously, if this is the only life you have, it's almost no point in doing deep spiritual practice. Because, you know, as we know, is only a limited amount of progress that we can make in a single life. I mean, some of us make enormous progress, but some of us find that there's actually a lot of inner work that we need to do before even small transformations happen. But when we understand that we are actually in a process in which we've been practicing and looking into ourselves for lifetimes, which is why we get to do this in such a privileged way in this lifetime, it actually is very encouraging when we're looking at and working at some of the tough stuff that we have to deal with in a particular lifetime. So, in the Eastern traditions, and I know many of you know this, there's a very beautiful understanding that that the earth plane, which is known as Karma Bhumi, the place of action, the place of karma, is unique and special because it's the only place in the cosmos where we actually have the power to change. You know, it's said that in the higher regions, there's no gap between a thought and an action. In the higher regions, we're in the many, many astral regions, which the Hindu and Buddhist traditions and also the Christian and Jewish traditions actually see as part of the subtle world, that in these higher realms, they're actually realms of karmic reward. They're places where we get to be reborn when our actions have been very beautiful. But there's nothing we can really do to evolve or change in these worlds. And in the lower worlds, we are assigned to work out certain life lessons that we haven't managed to work out in this earth plane. And in the same way, there's no evolution possible there. We simply undergo the consequences of, you know, the murders and other difficult actions that we might have, that might have occurred to us on earth. So to have the karma to be born as a human being on the earth plane is an enormous opportunity, because here we can make decisions and perform actions, intervene in the process by which thoughts become actions, see our habitual patterns and shift them. And so this is why our lives here are so incredibly privileged, are so incredibly powerful. Because here we can make decisions that allow us to understand why we suffer, if we're suffering, how to change, how to transform those misunderstandings in us that cause our suffering, and also so that we can help to change the world. It's because of the law of karma that we can move away from situations that create suffering and towards freedom, towards inner freedom. So there's a few facts about karma that one derives from reading the texts of the traditions. Karma is inexorable. It's said that there's no place in this universe where one does not undergo the consequences of actions performed by oneself. And another one of the great yogic writers, the sage Vyasa, said, "The moon may grow cold or the sun start to boil, but one's actions never cease to bear fruit." So, karma is inexorable. Yet certain karmas can be changed. The same sage who said there's no place in the universe where you don't undergo the consequences of actions performed by yourself also said, "There is no power greater than actions performed in the present moment." So what we do, the karmas we create now, have the power to override anything that goes on in the past. So these two facts, karma is inexorable, action must bear fruit, we'll explain how this works later, yet certain karmas can be changed, is really the basis of what we're learning and practicing here. The second sequence here that's important is to understand karma works through motivation and emotion, through the mind and the will, and therefore by changing the tendencies in your own mind, changing your emotional tendencies, you change your karma. This is one of the most important and radical teachings about action, and that is that what really matters in action is motivation. I mean, the famous example that's given is that of the surgeon and the gangbanger. You know, they both use a knife, but one is motivated by healing and the other by anger or greed. So by that token, the doctors, if a patient dies on the surgeon's table, the responsibility of the doctor really has to do with his own skill, but it's consequences of such an action are really determined in great part by the motivation of the doctor. But the interesting thing is, and of course, such a thing will have consequences, but they won't be the consequences of somebody who uses a knife out of motives of hatred or greed. But of course, there's a wrinkle here, because most of us have mixed motivations for our actions. So often, what we do is partly motivated by altruism, partly by economics, partly by the desire to demonstrate our skills, partly by just pure ego, partly by competition. You know, there's a vast range of motives in all our actions. And this is one of the reasons why when we look at our own karmic patterns, what we see is that there's actually a tremendous mixture of consequences that we're living out. And, you know, if you look at your sheet here, what you see is that, actually it's not on the sheet, so I'm telling you about it now. Yeah, it's on page 2. There are actually 3 types of karmic results. There are positive, which are the results of positively motivated thoughts and actions, negative, which are the result of harmfully motivated thoughts and actions, and mixed, which are the ones that result from mixed motives, which, as I say, are present in almost any situation. The Buddhists, who are very, very much, they teach a lot about karma and about very specific karmic issues. There's a story about a woman who was a beggar woman in Buddha's time, and she lived in a kingdom where the Buddha and all of his monks used to come and spend the rainy season, which is when monks traditionally stay in one place. And the king would, every day, he would feed the monks. He would carry, you know, have the servants carry plates upon plates upon plates of fruit and beautiful food to the monks. And the beggar woman would watch this act of generosity of the king's and just marvel at how beautiful and wonderful it was that he was able to do this, that he was able to feed so many people. And every day the Buddha would stand up and say, "I want to thank the generosity of this particular king." And then one day he, as he was making his speech to the monk, he said, "The most generous person in this kingdom is the beggar woman Mangala." And the king was outraged that he had mixed motives for his generosity. He said, "How can that be? How can this beggar woman be more generous than me?" And the Buddha said, "Because her generosity, her well-wishing, her love for you, for your generosity, is actually of a higher order of generosity than your beautiful, generous action." So, of course, this is a teaching story that tells us it's really all about motivation. And a story that I've always loved, because it's very helpful when you actually feel like there's nothing you can do in a situation, that you don't have the power to do anything in the situation, that there is actually enormous power in blessing, in well-wishing, and in loving the good actions of others. So, and another aspect of it, which is, again, this is very Buddhist, is that when we perform an action, what makes it stick, what makes it binding, is our desire for an outcome. And for example, say you give $200 to Doctors Without Borders, and you do it because you want to help. And at the same time, there's a part of you that sort of holds back, that thinks later, if you hadn't given the money, that you'd be able to afford the iPhone, that, you know, you could buy the iPhone 4. So there's some regret, and this is often the case with our actions. And the result is that there are several kinds of residual traces left in your subtle body as a result of that action. So there'll be the pleasure of making an offering, of feeling useful, and there'll be a trace of aversion from wishing you still had the money. And there will also be a powerful yogic impression that will be created by your having overcome your aversion to giving the money and acting generously. So, you know, every action that you make, including your spiritual actions, will be mixed in this way. But the important thing is that the trace that's left in you by that little bit of effort that you make to do something generous or to do something disciplined is going to create a more and more powerful experience of that transformative quality. So one of the interesting ways that contemporary neurophysiologists are understanding the way karmic traces work is by looking at the fact that the brain actually holds on to memories, that there are specific parts of the brain in which what's called implicit memory is lodged. There, in the 1960s, William Penfield, who was a neurosurgeon, made a pioneering recognition that really started a whole set of experiments in neurophysiology. And again, many of you may have heard this. He was performing a procedure on the brain of an epileptic, which involved attaching electrodes to certain centers in the brain. And as he moved the electrodes around, the woman began to have vivid sense memories of scenes in her early life that she had no conscious memory of. And they would come up with total clarity, sights and smells, what it felt like to be in her mother's kitchen. And this was one of the first times that we began to have concrete proof that everything is stored within the brain. So, and the more we understand about neuronal connections and neuronal patterning and implicit memory, the more we can recognize at least the physical traces of how karmic patterning works. You know, the physical body is actually, in a certain sense, it's a condensed physical version of the subtle storehouse that we call the mind. And in the yogic tradition, in the yogic texts, there are two words for this patterning, for karmic patterning. The first is samskara, which is a groove in consciousness. It's a track in the subtle body that's left by the internalized memory of an experience. And if you look at the top of your chart, you see that the root of karma is rooted in samskara, in these latent mental impressions, these implicit memories, that are lodged in the subtle body from events that occurred in this life and from events that occurred in many past lives. So, and it's, again, we're quite familiar with this. If you meet Johnny and have a pleasant time with him, you'll be left with a certain impression, with a pleasant impression. There'll be a sense of ease and comfort or maybe attraction. And if you have enough pleasant encounters with him, you accumulate a body of samskaras. And interestingly enough, because of the mirror neurons in our brain, when you have a pleasant set of impressions about Johnny, something in your brain will tend to attract more such pleasant experiences of Johnny and of others, because the positive samskaras, the positive neuronal patterns in the brain actually work in a mirroring fashion with other people, so that people tend to mirror our inner feelings. But on the other hand, if one day Johnny and you are being very intimate and he suddenly turns on you and shouts at you or in some way breaks your sense of trust, then that particular samskara will also leave an impression. And because of the nature of the brain, and my sense is because of the nature of the subtle body, the negative impression will be stronger than the positive impression. It's a fact of the brain. As one writer says, that the brain is Velcro for negative experiences and Teflon for positive experiences. So it's one of the reasons why a lot of our accumulated karmic impressions tend to be of of difficult experiences in this and former life. So, are you with me? So, the second word for these impressions is vasana. And let me backtrack a moment. Again, this is on your chart, on your sheet. The samskaras, the buried, the hidden impressions of that have accumulated in this life and others, are lodged in as a kind of backpack in what the yogic text called the karmashaya, which literally means the karmic storehouse, which in the yogic text is said to reside in the subtle energy body of a human being and to be carried lifetime after lifetime as a kind of energy packet that goes with us when we move to a different body. So this is your karmic backpack, and it's become quite large. At least in the traditions, they say you've been accumulating karmas for perhaps millions and millions of years. Of course, we have no idea how long we've been making these rounds. The Buddhists say that karma is beginningless, which is a pretty intense thing to think about. And within the karmashaya, based on these deep buried samskaras, arise vasanas. And the word vasana means fragrance or flavor. I like to translate it vasana as a feeling based tendency. So you know how it is that for example, some people have a kind of a glass half full attitude towards life. Some people have more of a glass half empty attitude towards life. I have a friend who's extremely positive. So she's whenever time I complain about anything, which I do sometimes because I'm a little bit more of a glass half empty person, she'll say, "Well, how much effort does it take you to take a positive attitude towards this?" She has vasanas or tendencies towards seeing life through a positive through a gloss that tells her that everything is going to turn out all right. So the flavor of our vasanas, which is, you know, these vasanas, these tendencies determine our character, our approach to life, our sense of confidence. And as we said earlier, they can be positive, coming from the consequences of positive actions. They can be negative, the result of harmfully motivated actions. Or they can be, as they are for most of us, mixed. So, for example, and I think you can think of many people like this, and perhaps of yourself, I have a close friend who has a very she's very beautiful. She was born into a very wealthy and well-connected family. She's got a powerful tendency to help other people. A really very beautiful saintly tendency to help other people. And she has a tremendous lack of self-confidence. So she's in much of her life, she's stymied by not believing in herself. So you can see here that this is a person with mixed karmas. She's obviously done a lot of generous actions in the past because that's how you get to be beautiful and well-connected. It's one of the ways. She's obviously done a lot of spiritual practice in the past because it's given her a deep, deep spiritual capacity. And there have been events in her life, in her past, which have tended to make her not have confidence in herself. That may be because of ways she's failed. It may be because of the way other people have treated her. It may come from, as I suspect, certain religious attitudes. But in this lifetime there are things that are easy and flowing for her, things that are not so easy and flowing, and of course that's true for all of us, because the nature of our stored samskaras and vasanas, the nature of what's in our karmashaya, our karmic storehouse, is going to determine the kind of birth you have, that is, your parents, the circumstances in which you were born, how long you'll live, although I would say that in our modern era, due to the power of action in the present moment, many of us, because of the advances in modern medicine, probably live much longer spans of life than we might have otherwise if the samskaras for our physical body were allowed to play themselves out without the help of antibiotics and all our understandings about health and environment. So the type of birth you have, your lifespan, and your experience of pleasure and pain, your ability to have a good time and to suffer, and the circumstances that arise in your life that cause these things. So there's another piece that I find very interesting, which is that that your positive karmic imprints have really two effects. First of all, they give you the capacity for living a good life in the world, that is, for being a mensch, for honesty, for kindness, for all the qualities, for having good relationships. And they also give you worldly success, the capacity to make money. They give you a beautiful body, etc., etc., etc. So your positive karmic imprints can give you a lot of worldly success and power, but they can also give you another kind of what we might as well call good karma, which is to say an inclination to doing spiritual practice. And in the traditions, this is not really the way of the West, but in the Eastern traditions, the belief is that the best karma, the goodest of good karmas, is to have what's called the tendency to renunciation or to letting go. Because when we have the ability to let go, that is, to not attach ourselves too much to outcomes, then we have a really good chance of freeing ourselves from a lot of our karmic issues. So one of the signs of good karma is beauty, wealth, a character that's naturally inclined to generosity and honesty, etc. And another sign of good karma is an interest in spiritual practice. And the negative karmic imprints will give you the opposite. So difficulty doing good things or difficulty doing well in life is usually the result of lack of generosity, violence, other sorts of negatively motivated actions. And the antagonism towards spiritual practice or having difficulties in spiritual practice, which many of us do, almost everybody who practices meditation, who does spiritual practice of any kind, finds that we come up against certain obstructions in our practice. And generally speaking, these obstructions are the result of, of samskaric situations that are in our subtle body, which literally come up and block our ability to touch the inner world. And this is actually one of the reasons why we do many spiritual practices, such as mantra, chanting, purificatory actions of different kinds. And in one of the later classes, we'll talk about that, about how we purify specific karmas, especially in spiritual practice or in our ability to make money or to have good relationships. That, where there is teachings on the nature of karma, there are also teachings on how to cure specific karmic issues. This is one of the reasons why understanding karma is so important. So there are three types of karma, and I'm going to speak about them in just a moment. But let's first take a moment to turn inside and practice our sweeping breath. So you can allow the breath to flow in, flowing up through the toes and out through the crown. Down from the crown with the exhalation and out through the toes. Again, just allowing the breath to flow in this way as though it were flowing through your empty body, through your body that's filled with space. And as the breath flows in, have the sense that you're taking in benign and loving and enlivening energy. And as the breath flows out, have the feeling that you're releasing and relaxing any tensions, any holding that you're aware of in the body. Open your eyes. There are three types of karma that we experience. They're called destined karma or prarabdha karma in Sanskrit. Stored karma, or sanchita karma in Sanskrit, and kriyaman karma, or the karma of our present actions. The prarabdha karma, or destined karma, is essentially the karma that you come in with that is like, my guru used to compare it to the food you take. You know, if you're on a journey and you have food in your backpack, that's the food you have with you for the journey. So your prarabdha karma, your destined karma, is what you've brought with you. And it's, you know, this is your body type, the strength of your constitution, your parents, many, many things about your life are what we call prarabdha karma. And many of our relationships are part of our prarabdha karma. There's a, you know, it's an interesting question, and I'm going to ask you to contemplate it during the week. One of the ways we actually can understand this is to look at the patterns. There are certain patterns of our life. You know, when we ask ourselves, you know, what is my karma? What is my destiny? Is this accident karma? Is this piece of good fortune karma? One of the ways we know or we sense the situation in our life is what we call karmic, is that it's unavoidable. In other words, it's part of a path. It's either an event that sits there in our path, whether we've done anything to make it happen or not. And another way that we know is if it's part of a pattern of events. For example, if you have a tendency to have a certain kinds of relationships, and you stand back and actually look at the way relationships have played out in your life and notice a pattern there, then what you're probably looking at is a karmic tendency. For people like ourselves who are essentially very privileged, very fortunate people, having been born where we were born and having the opportunities, especially the spiritual opportunities that we have, one of the ways that Parabdha karma or destined karma operates is through our mind, through the kinds of thoughts and attitudes we have. And, again, to reiterate, the most important aspect of karma from the point of view of how we function in life is really the way our mind is formed. In other words, if you have a basically auspicious mind, a positive mind, that it allows you to persevere even when things are very tough. If your mind is less strong, then it means that you need to do quite a lot of practice and work to strengthen it. And the good news is that you can, and I'm here to tell you this because I've done it myself. So the second type of karma, called sanchita karma, is actually the karma that's still there in the karma shaya, the karmic storehouse, and it's the reservoir of karmas that we've been talking about earlier, which has been stored for lifetimes and lifetimes as subliminal memories in our subtle bodies. In the Kundalini tradition, it's said that these karmas are actually stored in the Sushumna Nadi, the channel, the very subtle channel that runs up, that corresponds to the spinal column, and that runs from the base of the spine to the crown of the head. And one of the traditions in the tradition of Kundalini is that when the Kundalini energy is awakened in the body, that it actually moves up through this Sushumna Nadi and dispels these traces. And this is, in fact, again, I can tell you this from my own experience, this is, in fact, one of the effects of deep meditation, is that the energy of transformation moves through your body in meditation and begins to dispel or burn, as the yogic saying goes, these stored sanchita karmas. And the third type of karma is what we're doing now, which is, of course, our area of choice, our area of activities. So one of the things that I'd like to talk about now is the question of karmic relationships. And we'll start to look at them during the class. And then I'm going to ask you to practice, to do a particular practice for working with karmic relationships or with a particular karmic relationship. The fact is that we all have certain relationships, as you know, in which there's ease and flow. And we also have certain relationships that just feel sticky and difficult. And a karmic relationship is one in which you often find yourself feeling unaccountably drawn to somebody, or there's a feeling of obligation to them, about them. And sometimes the sense of obligation is very positive. You help each other, you do great things for each other. Sometimes it isn't. And it's in the places where it isn't that we tend to get stuck. One of the most haunting stories I know, I have to tell you a really, really heavy-duty karma story, okay? Because I think every one of us has something like this in our life, not necessarily as dramatic as this one. So this is a woman I met years ago in New Mexico. She was Swiss, and she'd been a well-known stage actress in Switzerland in the 70s, and she told me that one day she was sitting in the lobby of the theater where she was performing, and she saw a man walking across the lobby towards her. She experienced a feeling of tremendous dread and a feeling of tremendous attraction. They fell in love. They got married. He became her manager. And over a period of 5 years, he managed to run through all her savings. He spent her earnings on cocaine. He was extremely abusive towards her in many, many ways. And she found herself kind of stuck in the relationship, always trying to please him. She said that she would do anything she told her to do, including making decisions that were terrible for her career, and she couldn't bring herself to leave him. And then one night she had a dream, and she saw herself in an old-fashioned dress, hugely pregnant. A man burst in the door, and she somehow realized that in this life it was her husband who had been away at war for a couple of years and had come back to find her pregnant with another man's child. And in the dream, she experienced profound terror and then experienced herself being strangled by her husband. She woke up and realized that this is how she died in this dream. She'd been killed by her husband, and she woke up with the realization that this was the karma between them. She remembered that her dread, her fear, her sense of obligation that she'd had towards him, and she saw that this intensely difficult and charged relationship was a residue of that old life. She had a debt to him, and he had a debt to her. And it was at that point that she was actually able to rationally leave the relationship. And for many of us, as I say, not necessarily that traumatic, there are relationships in which there is this kind of sense of debt between us. And often we feel a recognition or a sense of familiarity with a person that draws us intensely. Often we fall in love with somebody because it's the only way we can come together to work out these karmas. We might have such an experience with a parent, with a business partner, certainly with our children often. These are the kind of situations where our therapist might say, get out of this, but we can't. And often because we feel responsible for their happiness, guilty about making them suffer. And sometimes it's the other way around. There may be people in your life who feel responsible for your happiness. And sometimes, again, if you look very deeply into your life, you might see that this is the case, that there's someone in your life whom you think should help you, who you think should help make you happy. And, we blame them for not loving us enough or for not being there for us. In Tibetan, there's a word for this kind of relationship. The word in Tibetan is lenchak, which is translated as karmic debt. Len means time, and chuk means attachment or attraction, being drawn to somebody, but in an unhealthy way. And this is a dynamic that comes from past life relationships, from having been in certain similar situations over lifetimes. So if you've ever seen a couple, or if you've been in a couple, or been in a parent-child relationship where one person is always making demands and the other fulfilling them, or where the parent is almost like the slave of the child, or vice versa, you see lenchak in action. And, of course, this sometimes gets played out in work situations. I've been in a few of those myself, where you just feel obligated to serve another member of your team, or to give opportunities to someone else rather than taking them yourself, or where you just go on helping somebody endlessly. And this is not a karmic choice. I'm sorry, this is not a conscious choice. How we sometimes offer service out of pure love. It's more like a compulsion. And there's a Tibetan legend, I guess you could call it a rural myth, about how this works. It's said that there's a certain lake in Tibet where during a particular full moon, the seal-like creatures who live in the lake gather fish in their mouths, and flocks of owls gather in the trees above the lake, and the seals begin throwing fish to the owls. There's absolutely no reason why they do this, but they seem to be compelled to do it, and the owls seem to expect it. And no matter how many fish they're offered, the owls are never satisfied. And this goes on until daybreak on this particular full moon. So the seals keep offering the fish, and the owls keep demanding more fish, as it were. And this is the dynamic of a karmic relationship. Sometimes we find ourselves being the seal, and sometimes we find ourselves being the owl. When we're the seal, we feel emotional responsibility to someone. We have to do things for them. We worry about them. And yet at the same time, there's a dread, as if we've been captured by that person, so to speak. And that person often is simply never satisfied. The seal person keeps on trying to do things for the owl person, and the owl person, no matter how many favors we give them, no matter how many times we listen to his troubles or give him money or gifts, it's never enough. So, this is a very interesting way to examine some of your karmic relationships. Have you ever felt karmically pulled towards someone in a way that felt that wasn't free? Or did you ever have the feeling about someone that they owe you something? This is a karmic relationship. And I want to offer you a practice which I'm going to ask you to do when you when you're at home, so to speak, when you're in your room. I'll send you the details of it this week. It's a practice for working with an entangled karmic relationship. And the relationship you work with doesn't necessarily have to be one that's painful or unpleasant for you. But it should be one where there's a sense of entanglement, where there's a sense that what's holding you together is not completely free. Where there's a feeling of obligation that may or may not be rational. And it may be someone who's present in your life, or it may be someone who's past in your life. But where you see this sense of obligation towards them, or a sense that they owe you something, especially if you feel that you're not getting what you think they owe you, consider that person, bring that person to mind. See if you can feel the energy of that person. See if you can imagine yourself in a situation where the feeling of owing something or of being owed something is very present. And we're going to do a practice that some of you may have done before, which is the practice of cutting the karmic cords that in an entangled situation we mutually send out to each other. And I want you to know that when we do it, I'll give you the instructions in a moment, you're not cutting off your love for that person or your true caring for that person. What you're doing is cutting the cords of karmic debt, the lend check that forces you to feel that you're obligated to them or that they owe you something. So close your eyes. Breathe in through your toes and up to the crown of your head, and breathe out from the crown of your head down to your toes. And have the feeling now that you're sitting with this person feeling the energy between you. And become aware of the presence of slender, subtle cords that connect you to this person. If you're very entangled with them, very, very karmically bound to them, there may be cords that come from many, many parts of your body and are connected to their bodies in this subtle way. And now imagine yourself cutting those cords without any feeling of aversion or fear. Imagine yourself taking silver scissors and cutting through the cords. Or perhaps you'd like to pluck out the cords from your body and just allow them to float back to this person. When you feel that you've taken out many of the cords, then say to that person inwardly, I no longer want to be entangled with you in this way. I want our relationship to be based on freedom. I no longer want to be entangled with you in this way. I want our relationship to be based on freedom. And it may seem that something else is more appropriate to say to them. Say what comes up in your heart. Imagine that you're holding a flower. And offer the flower to this person. See them accepting it. Imagine now that you fold your hands and bow with a deep sense of honor. I'm going to ask you this week to do two assignments. One is to work with this practice, and as I said, I'll send you the instructions. And the other is to take some time to look into what you think may be your karmic patterns in the areas of work and relationships. And I'll also send you the instructions about how to do that. And again, you may want to have a partner so that you can both share your experience, which is often very helpful, and discuss what you're coming up with. And I'm also going to ask you to do a practice of meditation with a mantra. I'm going to give you the mantra now and also give it to you in written form. And I'll also be sending you a download that's going to be available through the listserv, through the private area on the website. That will be an actual guided meditation in this mantra. And the mantra that we'll be practicing with is one of the mantras in the opening invocation that we do. It's the 5-syllable mantra, Namah Shivaya. The reason that we're going to practice with this mantra, which I know many of you already practice with, is because it is specifically a mantra that purifies karmas. It's an extremely powerful practice for an extremely powerful Kriyaman karma, a spiritual practice that has the capacity in a very beautiful and very immediate way to actually clear and purify, if you like that word, the karmic traces in our body and mind. And we're going to practice it, because this is how I like to meditate, we're going to practice it in the heart. So, find yourself a posture that's comfortable and upright, allowing your sitting bones to sink into the chair, into the seat, into the cushion. Allowing the crown of your head to rise up towards the ceiling. Letting the chest lift and the shoulder blades release onto the back. And allow your attention to center in the heart, not the physical heart, but the heart center, somewhat to the right of the physical heart in the center of the chest, deep inside the body. And feel that the breath flows in to the heart. The breath flows in with the thought, Namah Shivaya, Namah Shivaya. Namah, meaning I offer my salutations. Shivaya, meaning the ground of being, the inner self, the inner teacher. Inhaling Namah Shivaya into the heart. And as you exhale, see if you can feel the syllables of the mantra gently caressing and opening your heart, making space in your inner body. Namah Shivaya into the heart. And then just let the exhalation arise. Inhaling with Namah Shivaya. And exhaling, just allowing the heart space to soften and open. Have the feeling that the syllables of the mantra are mingling with the breath, dropping into your inner body, dropping into your heart, as if you were offering flower petals of sound into your own heart, or as if the mantra were gentle drops of rain. The syllables don't have to be distinct. Namah Shivaya, as you practice it, it'll become fuzzy and kind of soft. And as thoughts arise, as soon as you notice yourself thinking, note the thinking and just gently come back to the mantra. You're breathing in the mantra as an offering to your own inner body, to the divine self, the ground of being within the heart. And as the mantra flows in with the inhalation, the heart, that center within the chest, just gently releases and relaxes and expands during the exhalation. And you let Om Namah Shivaya flow with the breath into the heart. Om Namah Shivaya with the inhalation, the exhalation flowing silently, allowing the residue of the mantra to flow through your body, to expand your heart, to gently carry away karmic traces from this day, from this week, from this life. Namah Shivaya. I honor the great self, the ground of being, the creative spaciousness, the awareness, love that is the heart of me. Namah Shivaya on the inhalation. An open, expansive exhalation. Sit for a little while. Let yourself sit with the mantra and the breath. You'll be receiving homework for the week. And you can sit with the mantra for 20 minutes, either in the morning or the evening. And you'll also receive instructions for the contemplation that we did earlier. On relationship. Have a beautiful week. Don't forget to doing on the serve and ask any questions or share any experience that may come up. Many, many blessings. Namaste.